I'm Andrew Walter. This is number 0187, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0187. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Robert Hammond, who is the author of Ready When You Are, Cecil B. DeMille's 10 Commandments for Success. It's not the first book he's written about the showman. What inspired him to write about Cecil B. DeMille?
When I really learned about his life, I felt this is a guy whose own story has not been told. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. And it was like one night I actually jumped up in the middle of the night and I go, has there been a big movie made about Cecil B. DeMille? You know, the greatest showman on earth. And I Googled it, I looked all over, and I was like, no, there's been some documentaries here and there about Hollywood and about him, but nothing like a real big epic movie. And so that's where I really first got really turned on by his story, his own personal story.
Milt Larson is the co-founder of Hollywood's legendary The Magic Castle and author of The Magical Journey, The First 30,000 Days. Did he ever think his little venue would be so popular so many years later?
Quite honestly, we had no idea it would be this successful. My brother Bill and I were both in the television business and kind of never going into the club business. So we thought we might have a little club with a bunch of magicians hanging around. And we opened with 150 magicians. And 50 years later, we have 5,000 magicians. So I guess we had absolutely no idea where we were going.
Dr. Gloria Horsley talks about grief. How do you deal with people who have recently lost a loved one?
Human touch is really important. I like people to, give the arm or just tap them, just touch their arm, if you're not comfortable giving them a hug. But, and you can ask them if they give you a hug, because hugs are actually brain changers. When you hug people who are in grief, it actually changes chemicals in the brain. And so hugs are very good.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff. And, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0187 was Andrew Walter, who runs the digital arm of a PR group in San Francisco. He was also a producer on my old radio show way, way back in the day. One of the best ones at it, I have to say. And he's also the world's greatest son to a very proud mom. Thank you very much, Andrew, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, employees at the Walmart store in Glendale, Arizona, because, everything happens at Walmart. Anyway, they saw a man allegedly pocket a pack of cigarettes. When confronted, the man allegedly walked out, then came back and threw his keys at an employee. He then, witnesses say, grabbed a bottle of booze from a shelf and hurled it through the front window, smashing it. Then it gets weird. Trust me. The man allegedly took 12 employees hostage in the store's break room, telling them to lock the door and sit on the floor. When told the door didn't have a lock, he started pacing back and forth. Police arrived and learned the weapon the man was using to hold the hostages was a fire extinguisher. When the suspect raised it in a threatening manner, an officer shot him with a taser. Ryan Herman, age 23, was charged with unlawful imprisonment, assault, shoplifting, and aggravated assault on a police officer. A dozen employees held captive with a mere fire extinguisher. It's not like this guy's MacGyver. That's what happens when Walmart in the United States doesn't pay employees enough to afford the guns that Walmart actually sells, because they do sell guns. Anyway, moving right along, Gene Kwan, the mayor of Oakland, California, publishes a newsletter for residents. She recently accepted an advertisement for a class on how to pick locks, which even included an opportunity to buy the tools for lock picking. Some local citizens thought the class unnecessary. Oakland has already seen a 40% increase in burglaries in the past year. What's next, griped a resident in an online forum. Fundamentals of armed robbery? Mayor Kwan says she appreciates people's concerns and she'll work on avoiding similar upsetting content in the future. Okay, what classes does she plan to take for that? And wait a minute, now that I think about it, why is someone actually offering a class that teaches people how to pick locks in the first place? That's what I want to know. Now, on the last program, and on several programs in the past, I've often talked about zero tolerance stories. They just drive me batty. I had several of them in the last program, number 0186. Well, I've got, there's always leftovers, because zero tolerance stories never, ever run dry. We'll call this one Zero Tolerance Birthday Treat Edition, shall we? The lunacy that is zero tolerance continues to raise its ridiculous head, and here's the birthday edition. Now, since third grader Casey Fountain of Caro, Michigan, was turning 9 on a school day, his mother sent cupcakes to a class along with him. Actually, she sent 30 cupcakes, because, you know, enough for everyone. It's always good to share. But the boy's father said he got a call from Susan Wright, the principal of Shall Elementary School, saying the decorations on the cupcakes were insensitive. On the cupcakes, she had put 2 toy soldiers. Considering that there was a school shooting in another state a few months ago, this was a big concern for the principal. The school removed all the Green Army men and replaced them with different decorations. Here's a quote from the principal. "We walk a delicate balance in teaching nonviolence in our buildings and trying to ensure a safe, peaceful atmosphere." She also added that she meant no disrespect for the military, who defend our right to have differences. She then played the child safety card and noted, "Living in a democratic society entails respect for opposing opinions." Well, you meant no disrespect to the military and their families, but you know what? You did nonetheless. There's a difference between government officials respecting rights and government officials prohibiting them. I'll get off the soapbox now. One more Stuff File news story before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Megan Thode of Nazareth, Pennsylvania, got a C+ in her 2009 fieldwork class, but says she needed a B to move on to the next one. Rather than work to improve her grade, says Lehigh University attorney, Thode instead lawyered up. She sued the university, alleging breach of contract and discrimination, saying that the mark scuttled her dream of being a licensed professional counselor. The university says Thode got a 0 in class participation after swearing in class and having an outburst and crying. Unprofessional behavior for a therapist. Thode is the daughter of a finance professor at the school and not only thus attended the university tuition-free, but was also paid by the university for jobs they found for her. Thode, who was 27, graduated with a master's degree in human development and had to settle for being a drug and alcohol counselor. Her attorney, Richard J. Orlowski, asked for $1.3 million in damages, saying that was the lifetime salary difference between the job she wanted and the one she got. Northampton County Judge Emil Giordano threw out the case. Thode is considering an appeal. Wouldn't it just be easier to retake the class? Yeah. And by the way, how does someone get a degree in human development when clearly they haven't finished developing as a human themselves? That's what I'd like to know. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. This year marks 100 years since Cecil B. DeMille started making films in Hollywood. He was a visionary in the art of movie making. Robert Hammond is the author of Ready When You Are, Cecil B. DeMille's 10 Commandments for Success. He's on the line with us right now from California. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on. Now, this is not the first book you've written about Cecil B. DeMille, correct?
No, I've written a couple of books on him. Ready When You Are, the one you just mentioned, it's like 10 Commandments for Success, more of a self-help book I wrote for people who just want to learn about DeMille and kind of the principles they can apply. But I also did a novel called C.B. DeMille, The Man Who Invented Hollywood. And that's really a kind of a fictionalized, you know, based on his real life, but just really a story about early Hollywood and how he came out here and really battled all these big moguls and his own vices and, you know, gave into temptation and overcame all that to really build up this, you know, create this place we call Hollywood.
Now, you're a screenwriter and a producer and an author, and you are out there in California. You've written two books that have a theme around Cecil B. DeMille. Why is he so important to you, and why do you feel he's so important to Hollywood?
Well, you know what? I've been writing books for years, you know, on various topics, everything from personal finance to just, you know, consumer advocacy. And when I've always been a writer, and I've loved screenwriting, I've loved Hollywood, and you know, I've been involved in making films. And when I really learned about DeMille, even though I've always known about him, you know, I knew about The Ten Commandments and The Greatest Show on Earth, some of those big old classics. But when I really learned about his life, I felt this is a guy whose story, his own story, has not been told. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. And it was like one night I actually jumped up in the middle of the night and I go, has there been a big movie made about Cecil B. DeMille? You know, The Greatest Showman on Earth. And I Googled it. I looked all over and I was like, no, there's been some documentaries here and there about Hollywood and about him, but nothing like a real big epic movie. And so that's where I really first got really turned on by his story, his own personal story. And it's a story about any person, you know, like you or me, who struggles with life and really caught a vision of something that was bigger than himself and came out here with nothing, really, and just risked everything to create a whole new industry.
What's the biggest myth that we think we know about Cecil B. DeMille? And conversely, what's the thing we don't know that we should?
Wow, there's so many of them. That's a good, excellent question. I think probably the biggest myth is that he was just, you know, like a big, you know, tyrant and, you know, just full of ego. And even though in many ways, you know, externally he did, you know, portray that, you know, the tyrant on the set, but he was a very humble person, you know, the reality of who he was, you know, very humble. You know, people thought he was like super right-wing extremist, you know, conservative. And truthfully, the Republicans wanted him to run for senator and, you know, they wanted him to testify against the blacklist and all kinds of things. But he really gave chances to people, you know, even people who were blacklisted, like Edward G. Robinson, for example. He gave him his first job after all that. So he was a really a compassionate man, a very humble man. He gave a lot of work and voice to minorities as well as to women, and you know, women working behind, not just on the, you know, the actresses, you know, we made stars. But, you know, women, you know, who are the screenwriters, you know, Jeannie McPherson, for example, and film editors and all the anyone who works in Hollywood today, especially working behind the scenes, writing and editing and working with cameras and things like that. A lot of the women and other minorities he gave and just people in general. I mean, that whole business really owes its industry to Cecil B. DeMille. He really put Hollywood on the map.
Was he just a giant of his time? And what I mean by that is, if he were around today, could he succeed in today's Hollywood?
Oh, absolutely. He, you know, pretty much still stood head and shoulders as far as his accomplishments over any director today. I mean, and we have people, you know, I'd say probably some of the closer ones to him would be someone like Steven Spielberg, you know, who actually his granddaughter, Cecilia DeMille Presley, she calls Spielberg kind of like the Cecil B. DeMille today, you know, because he does a really big epics. He loves the special effects. You know, I'd probably say someone like James Cameron, and there's others, you know, who do these really big over-the-top movies. But that's not all DeMille did, so that's why I know that it's not just about special effects with him, not just over-the-top spectaculars, which, you know, is kind of what he's known for in the biblical epics specifically. But he was really known for being a great storyteller, you know, and even though he didn't write the screenplays, but he really supervised them, and he really knew, you know, what's a good story, what's a good character, and he really gave parts, even to the, you know, he had like casts of thousands, and, you know, literally these extras, you know, people, you know, going through the, you know, crossing the Red Sea and all that, you know, all those little extras that were out there, You know, every one of them had a little part to play. You know, he didn't just treat them all, here, you're just a big crowd of people. No, here, you're the person who's, you know, got to make sure you look after your blind grandfather. You know, you're the one over here playing with the little doll. You know, every little character he really, you know, treated specially.
Now, you mentioned contemporaries of today like Spielberg and Cameron, and the thing you can say about those two gentlemen are they are themselves visionary, but they're also storytellers and directors who have a lot of power and produce their own work. When you go back to DeMille, he was certainly one of those types of characters, but weren't there more of them then? And by that I mean, it seems the filmmakers of those days were just that, filmmakers, as opposed to business people who happened to make films.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There was, well, back when DeMille started, I mean, we're talking 100 years ago, so just really putting it in perspective, when you first, back 1913, I mean, literally 100 years ago, when someone said the word movies, you know, what they were talking about at that time were the Nickelodeon little peep shows at a penny arcade. I mean, you literally put 5 cents, aka Nickelodeon, into a little thing, turn a crank, and you'd watch a strip tease, or you'd watch a guy taming a lion, or, you know, a little train, you know, for 5 minutes or so. And that was what people thought were movies. So the early filmmakers, you know, who really started making, you know, the big films, you know, the D.W. Griffiths, you know, people like that, they were amazing storytellers. And they took, you know, in many cases, they would take, like, you know, like DeMille particularly, you know, like a biblical story or some historical event or just some major, even things like just train wrecks and things like that, which is one of the things DeMille was known for. In fact, kind of tying it back to Spielberg, the first movie Steven Spielberg ever saw was The Greatest Show on Earth, which was a big circus movie, if you had a chance to ever see that one, which also had Charlton Heston in it. And it has a big train wreck in it. And so that was the first movie Steven Spielberg ever saw in his life as a little kid. And he came home so excited, you know, this big spectacular movie in his head, and especially that train wreck. And so he actually came back and took his own personal toy train, little Lionel set that his dad had given him for his birthday, and started running it off the tracks, you know, in his house. And when his dad saw him doing that, he says, "Here, I'm taking that thing away from you if you run that thing off the tracks one more time." And you know, the story, you know, Spielberg himself tells the story. He says that, you know, what he did is he grabbed the little home movie camera, the Super 8 movie camera, and took a video of, or a film of, his train going off the track, and that was literally the first movie he ever made. And so he was hooked from that point forward.
It's funny, you mentioned The Greatest Show on Earth. Wasn't that an award winner?
It was, and that was actually his only really Academy Award, you know, winning film, you know, because, you know, the Oscar or Academy Awards, you know, they came about, you know, not too many years before that. So yeah, that was the Oscar winning film.
And wasn't he chided that year? Wasn't the Academy chided that year because they didn't feel that was the best picture of the ones that were nominated that year?
Well, yeah, that's true. There were some other ones, I can't even think of them right off the top of my head, but I mean, that happens every year if you think about it. Yeah, there are oftentimes films, in many cases it kind of goes the other way around. You know, it would be probably like, you know, let's just say James Cameron had won for Avatar, you know, which probably a lot of people actually thought should have won, you know, but Catherine Bigelow won for The Hurt Locker, which a lot of people think, well, very, you know, artistically done, but, you know, was it really the best picture? So, you know, that whole question, you know, it's very political. You know, we all know the awards, there's a lot more to them. And just, it's so subjective to say, you know, what's really a best picture, you know, which is was that particular award. So, yeah, there was definitely some controversy about it. There were people who thought there were other, you know, more artistic films. That's one of the biggest questions in any kind of art today, you know, commerciality versus, you know, artistry. You know, is one exclusive of the other? And the truth is, just like with Spielberg, Cameron, you know, I'm just using those as a couple of examples, people who are very popular, just like, you know, let's just say Stephen King as a writer, you know, great storyteller. But a lot of people say, oh, well, he's not really, you know, that literary. Well, that's not really true. You know, I mean, bottom line is he's telling great stories, and that's what Steven Spielberg does. That's what Cecil B. DeMille did. And that's what I tried to do here by really getting DeMille's story out there. We're actually working on the epic, you know, biopic about his life, you know, because, his own stories is so tremendous, and it really relates to not just, you know, people in movies and people who want to get into show business or people in, you know, the film industry, but really just the average person, you know, because he really was, even though he had worked a little bit in theater, you know, he wasn't very successful. He didn't have a lot of money. He was, his mother, a single, parent. You know, his father died when he was young, and he really struggled. And so it was a big risk to say, here, we're going to basically sell the family silver, or literally pawn it, and come out to California, which, back then when you say California, you're talking orange groves and desert.
Now, as I mentioned, you are a screenwriter. You've written these books that involve DeMille, and you say there hasn't been a film made of this man. So I ask as the last question, Robert, what are you waiting for?
We are actually working on it as we speak. I got a meeting tomorrow with another producer. I have the screenplays written based on the novel C.B. DeMille. If you want to go to cbdemille.com, that's our actual website, which just kind of gives a little bit of background on him, and it's got a few articles. But that's definitely the question I've had, and it's one thing that you'll know if anyone has worked in this industry, that even someone like Spielberg, we'll just use him again. I mean, even people like him, it can take years and years to get a movie made, even when you've got the money, even when you've got the people, on board and you're the guy who can get it done. It's a tough, tough business. And back when Cecil B. DeMille was doing it, I mean, he was really pioneering the whole thing. So he had to fight, all the way. And even like the Ten Commandments, they wanted him to cut the budget in half. And, he actually did the first version of it back in 1923. A lot of people don't know that. His story is just an incredible story of just overcoming every single odd. And anybody, who's ever tried to overcome odds or got a vision of doing something that people just don't believe in what you're doing, but you just do it anyway. He's the kind of guy that will inspire you, and that's why I wrote Ready When You Are, because I really think people will be inspired, and anyone who's looking for any kind of transformation in their own lives, whether it's, show business kind of career or just, you want to take your life to another level, Ready When You Are is really written, from that perspective and showing how, kind of greater life can be lived. And, you can really do it no matter who you are.
The book is called Ready When You Are, Cecil B. DeMille's 10 Commandments for Success. It's written by Robert Hammond. And Robert, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Robert Hammond, author of Ready When You Are, Cecil B. DeMille's 10 Commandments for Success. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0187, and you'll find links to Robert's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the co-founder of the Magic Castle in Hollywood. Plus, we'll talk about grief with a grief expert. And, of course, we have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. Plus, more Stuff File news right here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a show that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. When a well-liked teacher retired from Orley Farm School in Harrow, London, England, the headmaster sent a message in the school newsletter. "It is with mixed feelings that I announce the retirement of Mr. Roger Clark at the end of this term. We all now know every really great teacher has to finish one day, and Mr. Clark will do so at the end of this term." Now, some thought the second sentence was worded a bit oddly, but Clark, who was 64 and who taught English, instantly recognized that the first six words of the second sentence make an acrostic, and when you take the initial letter from each word and put them together, they spell an insult. The school's governors were not amused at the coded message, and headmaster Mark Dunning, age 50, has resigned in disgrace after 7 years on the job. Now, by the way, if you missed the insult, it was in the words, "We all know now every really," which, if you take the first letter of each word, that spells wanker. Now that the headmaster is out of a job, perhaps he can concentrate on creating crosswords or missing letter word puzzles. He's got a knack for it, and he's needing work. Anyway, moving right along, India's annual Rural Olympics might be the cultural equivalent of several southern U.S. redneck Olympics, but taken somewhat more seriously in that this year, corporate sponsorships such as Nokia and Suzuki help fund the equivalent of about $66,000 in prize money for such events as competitive pulling using only one's ears or teeth. "We do this for money, trophies, fame, and respect," one ear puller told the Wall Street Journal in February. This year, in the four-day event in Punjab State, the 50,000 spectators, wow, 50,000 people watch this? Yikes. The 50,000 spectators could watch a teeth lifter pull a 110-pound sack upward for about 8 seconds, and an ear puller ease a car about 15 feet. Wow. Watching someone pulling something slowly, like a car, with their ear for about 15 feet, how exciting. I hope ESPN2 doesn't get wind of this, because they're already running out of things to show. And could you just imagine the reverse angle slow motion replay of this stuff? Yikes. Anyway, while we're still talking about athletes, and I'm using the term lightly here, I'm actually doing air quotes, leaders of the ice fishing community aiming for official Olympic recognition as a sport, really, have begun the process by asking the World Anti-Doping Agency to randomly test its athletes for performance-enhancing drugs. However, said the chairman of the U.S. Freshwater Fishing Association, "We do not test for beer because," he added, "everyone would fail that. Ice fishing is a lonely, frigid endeavor, rarely employing strength, but mostly requiring guile and strategy, as competitors who discover advantageous spots in the lake must surreptitiously upload the hauls lest competitors rush over and drill their own holes. It's nice to dream if you think you're a fledgling sport, but get in line." Urine tests have also been run in recent years on competitors in darts, mini golf, chess, and tug of war, and in 2011, one chess player, two mini golfers, and one tugger tested positive. Wow. If you have to dope to play mini golf, you have a sad mini life. We have time for one more story on the Stuff File News before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. The 14 guests at a jewelry party in Lake City, Florida, were initially incredulous that home invader Derek Lee, age 24, meant to rob them. But when they saw that he was serious by putting his gun to the head of one woman, the hostess went into action. "In the name of Jesus," she shouted, "get out of my house now." Then the guests chanted in unison, "Jesus, Jesus, Jesus," over and over and over, "Jesus, Jesus, Jesus." Lee, frightened or bewildered, sprinted out the door empty-handed and was later arrested. Yes, the Lord works in mysterious ways. Well, speaking of mysterious ways, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. The Magic Castle has been called the most unusual club in the world. Established in 1963, this private clubhouse was co-founded by Milt Larson and his late brother, Bill. Milt has a book out called The Magic Journey, The First 30,000 Days, about the magic place that is Hollywood's The Magic Castle. And Milt joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Milt. How are you?
I'm right here, and just fine. Thank you.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, when you started this with your brother way back when in 1963, did you ever think it would become this successful and certainly legendary?
Well, quite honestly, we had no idea it would be this successful. And, you know, my brother Bill and I, we were both in the television business and kind of never going into the club business, so... we thought we might have a little club with a bunch of magicians hanging around, and we opened with 150 magicians, and 50 years later we have 5,000 magicians. So I guess we had absolutely no idea where we were going.
Well, how did you end up making the leap, as you say, from television to working and owning a club? We should mention that you were a writer for Truth or Consequences, among other shows.
Right.
You did that
right.
for, what, 18 years with Bob Barker?
Right. I did that show for 18 years. When Bob Barker started doing it for daytime, I joined the staff, and we did it for 18 whole years. At the end of it, Bob went tandem with Truth or Consequences. He was doing Price is Right, and then finally, after all that time, it went off. But in the meantime, Ralph Edwards, our boss, knew I was doing a club, and he gave me a lot of time to develop it and do it. So, my brother and I were both, although we were in television, we were brought up in magic, and we were the Larson family of magicians. So my dad had passed away at fairly early age, and he always had an idea for doing a club, and Bill and I just thought, hey, why not? We found this wonderful old mansion in downtown Hollywood. It's only a block away from the Academy Awards Theater, and turned this 1910 Victorian mansion into a club in 1963. So it's kind of a wild and wacky story. You know, my book, Magical Journey, is just simply telling the story of a bunch of crazy kids that got loose, and a lot of magicians who liked what we were doing, and it all worked. You know, the magic trick of all time is that this crazy idea did work.
Now, it not only did you end up having all these members, but it became... and it still is the place for anybody who thinks they're a magician, never mind is one, aspires to be part of, right?
Right, but we have two forms of membership. There's the magician members who have to prove they're magicians, and then we have about half the members are people that just love watching good magic and having a place to do it. The castle itself has... four different theaters and good dining facilities and beverages and all that good stuff. But it started rather small, and it just kind of grew along with the more and more people, and we made a little more space in the old building. And as I said, we actually... attracted all sorts of wonderful members. You know, we have celebrity members, and we have just plain old ordinary folks that like magic.
Now, I understand there's also the Houdini's Seance Room. How long has that been part of the Magic Castle?
Well, actually, we started doing that about 10 years into it, so it's been there about 40 years. But the we have a very large Houdini collection of memorabilia. We got all the handcuffs and straitjackets and the original trunk that he got in and out of. And but we recreate the final Houdini seance, which was kind of famous. He died in 1926, and for 10 years they tried to see if he could come back, and it was a pretty dramatic thing. So he didn't, incidentally, but it was we recreate that moment in history, and it's all for fun. I mean, we don't take ourselves terribly seriously.
Didn't you guys have a fire a few years ago?
Yeah, about Halloween of what was that would have been 2011, but it happened on Houdini's. You know, Houdini died on Halloween, and we were having a Halloween celebration. It's Halloween is one of our bigger festivals at the castle, and strangely, there's a fire that started up in the attic of the big old mansion. It's about the equivalent of a four-story building, but the fire started with a blowtorch that had tipped over and started, but did quite a lot of damage, and you know, to the attic and the offices underneath the attic and then other rooms. But the fire department pinpointed the time of the fire, the origin of the fire, at exactly the time that Houdini died in Detroit, Michigan, in 1926, and almost to the minute. And that's pretty spooky. And, and then the other thing that's kind of weird about it is that the fire did a lot of damage to the floors below where it started. One of them was the Dante room, which was Dante the magician, who was a rival of Houdini's. And on the other side of the building, where the Houdini room was, it wasn't touched. You know, so they said, well, maybe there's something to Houdini being wherever he is and saying, I'll get even with those guys. You know, I've been coming back for 40 years, and they never paid me a royalty. So, you know, you never know about these things. There is something to it.
As you say, it's a creepy story. That story is enough to want to keep me out of that attic. Period.
Well, we don't let people up in the attic.
Good.
And happily, we were very well insured, and the castle was back and better than it ever was. So we were only actually closed for about 3 months of operation, and then we weren't closed entirely. We had operation going on in an annex building that we had. So it wasn't as tragic as it could have been. You know, it could have been really... If the fire had been later when we had 400 people in the building, that would not be good. So as it happened, it was in the morning before really anybody was there. So.
Now, you've written this book, The Magic Journey, The First 30,000 Days, and so many years of memories involved with the Magic Castle. When you sit down to write a book like this, you have to think about all these things. So when you look back at all the years of the Magic Castle, what's one of the fondest memories for you?
Oh, I guess probably maybe the fondest memory is the day we started it, because we had absolutely no idea that it was going to be as big as it was, and we had no idea what we were doing. So therefore, the opening day of the castle was very special in that, you know, we had our magician friends, and it was pretty well covered by the news and everything. So that had to be the occasion of occasions, you know. But over the years, I mean, you know, you can't be in a place for 50 years without having a thousand different wonderful best days of our lives in there. But it's, you know, we've had, you know, kings and queens and presidents and people. Ronald Reagan was there one day for one of our seances, and you know, it's really thrilling that you know, we're just a kind of a destination for magicians, I guess you'd call it, and know, people from all over the world, if they're headed for the West Coast and Los Angeles, they've got to see the Magic Castle.
I guess the best way, one of the ways to describe it would be it's Disneyland for magicians, isn't it?
You got it, yeah. And somebody described it as Disneyland with booze, but, you know, we do have adult beverage service.
But, good to know.
But, yeah, it is kind of Disneyland, and, you know, the wonderful thing about magic is it's totally fantasy, and when people go to the Magic Castle, they go to this secret door, and I mean, they open sesame to a carved owl and a bookcase, and the bookcase slides open, and then they're in this grand Victorian millionaire's mansion that we've totally restored to make it look like it came out of 100 years ago. And from the time they enter the door to the time they leave, they're in a different world of watching magicians do miraculous things. And I think that's what magic's all about. Is it's transporting people into a fantasy land of, you watch a magician, and, you know, you can look at films these days and you know, you don't know if it's computers or if it's real people or what, but if you're watching a magician on stage or particularly at the Magic Castle, where they're right in front of you, and you know, our close-up magicians will be 2 feet away and you still can't see what they're doing. So I think that's the excitement of magic, is the fact that to a magician, nothing is impossible. And to the average person, everything's impossible. So I think that's the secret to the whole thing. Not that I'd give away any secrets.
Of course. People can get a taste of the magic by checking out the book, The Magical Journey, The First 30,000 Days. I thank you very much, Milt, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thank you so much for calling.
Milt Larson, co-founder of The Magic Castle and the author of The Magical Journey, The First 30,000 Days. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0187, and you'll find links to Milt's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. 5 months after Superstorm Sandy pounded the East Coast, the cost of damage is estimated at $75 billion, making it the second worst storm in U.S. history. Sadly, we are now learning that the effort to rebuild after the storm was delayed by fears of lawsuits. Within 4 days of the storm, the American Institute of Architects had recruited 400 of its members to volunteer in assessing damaged properties. Their expertise would have greatly sped up rebuilding. But in the end, virtually none of them got anywhere near a battered home. Why? The architects feared they could be sued because the state of New York does not have so-called Good Samaritan laws to protect them from lawsuits. Let's be fair, 24 other states like California and Florida have these laws to help in times of emergency. Now, New York is finally considering similar protections. Will they be in place before the next storm? Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about grief. Plus, we will indeed have an idiot of the day. But first, we have one more Stuff File news story to get to before we get to our next guest. Richard Dameron has to let the world know that he's an idiot. A Cleveland judge has sentenced Richard to some public shaming for threatening police officers. Judge Pinky Carr. And how do you get through life with a name like Pinky Carr? Judge Pinky Carr is ordering Richard to stand in front of a police station with a sign reading, "I was being an idiot and it will never happen again." In addition, Dameron will have to serve 90 days in jail. At least he won't be standing in front of the police station in the cold. He'll be carrying his idiot sign for 3 hours a day for a week in June. I like it. And even though the judge has said that he's an idiot, he's not our idiot of the day. That comes a little later on in the program. But let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's hard to know what to say to someone who is mourning. Often, words people think are comforting have the opposite effect. On the line with us right now is a grief expert, Dr. Gloria Horsley. And she joins us from California. Hi, Gloria.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. I was looking at an article that mentioned the headline was the 10 most insensitive things you can say to a grieving person. And I think at some point or another, we have either been the recipient of, witness to, or heaven forbid, the perpetrator of at least some of these things.
I think that's probably true. They're pretty common. I think the thing is, when I mention them, people are going to recognize them because they've had it happen to them. You know, one of the things that bugs me the very, very most, my son was killed in an automobile accident many, many years ago. He was 17. And people still say to me to this day, oh, you never get over it. And, you know, I just look at him and say, you don't get over it. You transform it. It changes. It makes you more sensitive. I mean, there are growth things that actually come out of these experiences. It's not just this deep, dark hole.
So what are some of the 10 most insensitive things people have been saying?
Well, maybe one of the big insensitive things that people say to you is something like, you can have another baby if you've had a miscarriage or had a baby that died. Oh, you can have another one. Or for the people who are spouses, you can marry again. You're young. You know, those kinds of comments that, you know, you'll be able to do it. God has another angel. And, you know, God has another angel when a child dies, they'll say, or only the good die young. Oh, and I love it. You know, they'll ask you maybe, were they wearing safety belts when somebody gets killed in an automobile accident? So there are a lot of crazy little things people say.
So what should people say? Because, you know, you just mentioned one of them that I'm sure a lot of people might not even have thought was insensitive, the God has another angel line.
Right, exactly. And maybe some people like that. I mean, people, I think we get the feeling that people are comfortable with that because they'll talk about their angel baby or they'll do something about their angel baby or something like that. You know, but that's their perception. But not everyone, you know, likes to see it that way. So I say I used to take a casserole, and now I show up. And I think that's one of the main things you can do is just show up. You don't need to make any of these comments. You know, I think we get nervous when we're around bereaved people, and we think we have to say something. But I'll tell you, just showing up can be an amazing thing. Just being around. I remember after my son was killed, my pediatrician, I would be out in the yard gardening, and I would see him drive up and just walk around the yard and, you know, say hello to my kids. And in a little while, he wouldn't even be there anymore. So he showed up. I mean, there might be something you can do. You know, if it's wintertime, you can shovel somebody's walk. If it's summer, you can mow their lawn. You can just show up and do something. You can also take their kids places. You know, you can offer to drive kids to school or pick them up at ball practice or, you know, just things like that. So it's more what you do, not what you say.
Now, that's for, you know, after the fact, as it were, like you say, as time goes on. But in the immediate
right.
situation, like, for instance, people feel compelled to say something either at the viewing, at the service, at the funeral home, at those
right.
direct moments.
Absolutely. And what you can say is, I'm sorry. I'm truly, deeply sorry. You know, and some of us know, you know, we've had the experience. And if you've had the experience, say, I know what you're going through right now. But if you have not had the exact experience, do not say, I know what you're going through right now. Because if their spouse died, I don't tell people. I've been married for 50 years, thank goodness, and my husband's still around. And if I am dealing with bereaved spouses, I don't say, I know what they're going through. I've had a child die, but I have no idea what they're going through. Because there are different aspects to grief. There are different problems related to different types of losses. So, you know, I don't know what they're going through, but I'm very sorry to hear what you're going through. And you know, you show up. You don't need to say a lot. And, you know, if you're at funeral homes with people, you can help them out by giving them a glass of water or if you're, you know, happen to be around to do things like that or just putting human touch is really important. You know, I like people to, you know, give the arm or just tap them, just touch their arm, you know, if you're not comfortable giving them a hug. But, and you can ask them, can I give you a hug? Because hugs are actually brain changers. When you have people who are in grief, it actually changes chemicals in the brain. And so, you know, hugs are very good.
Would you say that especially in that immediate situation, the first thing to do is not rush over to the grieving person, but sort of do a little bit of recon and suss out what the room is like? In other words, let the situation dictate what you do?
I think that's a very good idea. Be aware of your environment, because they're certainly not aware of their environment, and particularly if there's been a high-profile death. You know, it's been in the paper and all that kind of thing. You really, you know, watching and seeing what's going on with people, because they can be absolutely flooded with people from the media, with all sorts of things. I've worked with the 9/11 families on a Columbia University study for the last 10 years, and those families are so flooded. And be aware of anniversary reactions, you know, when it's been a year or whatever. You might send them a card or something, but be aware, particularly in high-profile losses, that there may be a lot coming on these families at this time, or during trials, if it's been murder or something like that, that these families are going through a lot. Be sensitive to those holidays, anniversaries. People love to get an email or a card when it's a birthday or an anniversary of what has happened. So, yeah, be aware yourself and look around it and think about what you would want or what you might need.
Now, there's a foundation, the Open to Hope Foundation. People can check out the website, opentohope.com. What will people find there?
They'll find over 5,000 articles. We have 350 radio shows. We have TV shows. And we have some wonderful videos from experts in the field of grief and loss. Many, many experts have done YouTubes with us. And it's all tagged for content. So it's very specific, loss specific. So if you've lost a child, you can go there and hit on loss of a child, and it is very, very loss specific. Or if you've lost a spouse, you'll be able to go on and find something for loss of a spouse. Sorry, there's an airplane going over here.
Okay. Would it also be a good place to go, like you say, if you know, you suddenly find out, oh my gosh, my friend, relative lost someone close to them, I don't know what to do or say. Could it be a helpful place for someone to go if they don't know how to deal with someone else's grief?
Absolutely, because you can go on there and you can find a radio show. You can say, okay, my neighbor's just lost a child. You can go on there and you can find a radio show where we have interviewed people who've lost children who will tell you how it is, what to say. And you will find all, you know, just really specific examples of different people, and we try to put it in the titles of our shows and articles, and you'll be able to really understand what's going on with loss of a spouse, loss of a parent, you know, all sorts of things. We also have an international calendar there that I hope people who are listening to this will use and also go on to look at. There are many summer camps. There's lots of activities all around the world going on in grief and loss, and people come in and put those events on our calendar. And we also have forums, so you can go into the forums and talk about your losses and get some experts to answer questions that you might have about dealing with people.
The website is opentohope.com. Dr. Horsley, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Great. Well, thank you so much for letting me be on the show, and have a great day, and God bless.
Dr. Gloria Horsley. Again, the website is opentohope.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0187, and you'll find the links to Gloria's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Lee Wildman, age 35, and Adrian Stanton, age 32, pleaded guilty in connection with a burglary at Durham, England University's Oriental Museum, in which they heisted artwork worth the equivalent of about $2.7 million and hid it in a field back in April of 2012. However, they have been unable to help authorities locate the bounty, even with a reward of sentence reduction, because they have forgotten exactly where they stashed it. Eventually, hikers unconnected with the case discovered it and notified police. Said Judge Christopher Prince, "This is not an offense that could be described as sophisticated." Yeah. Why would someone commit a crime and quickly forget where they stash their bounty? One reason, and one reason only, they're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0187. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0187. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.